A Voice in Rama.
For our talk this afternoon, we'd like to have everybody turn to the 31st chapter of Jeremiah. And beginning with verse 1, we find that there's a special promise of the Lord's blessing upon his people. The people descended from the 12 sons of Jacob, all the families included in this chapter. But specifically, let's read verse 1. At that same time, saith the Lord, I will be the God of all the families of Israel, and they shall be my people. And if you look in the context, you'll see that here, this isn't being used in the sense of the full 12 families, but Israel's being used in the specific sense of the northern 10-tribe kingdom that had been taken captive. If you recall, their capital was Samaria. That's mentioned a few verses later. And more than 100 years before this prophecy was written, the Assyrians, under the command of Sennacherib, had taken them away. Some of the faithful came back from that. Proof is that we have the prophetess Anna, who was the first one to recognize the infant Messiah from the tribe of Asher. That would have been amongst the 10-tribe kingdoms. As we go through this chapter, everything seems to be a promise of return and deliverance and the Lord's blessing. And then we're stopped by verse 15. We're gripped with pathos, mourning, uncontrollable crying. Verse 15 says, thus saith the Lord, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel weeping for her children and refused to be comforted for her children, because they were not. Well, first we want to consider Ramah in this text. Jeremiah was writing very much to the political and military catastrophes of his own day. Jerusalem had been captured by Nebuchadnezzar. The temple, Solomon's temple, had been burned. This date of national disaster, and not the last national disaster, was the 9th of Ab. Still a time coming up very shortly for the Jewish calendar of national mourning. The victorious Babylonians used this very site, Ramah, as their headquarters. It was a staging area as well for their long march home. More correctly, the King James renders Jeremiah 31:15 Ramah, because it's trying to match up the New Testament Greek, and the Greeks didn't like pronouncing TH at the end of things. So more correctly, this is Ramoth, or an elevation. The designation appears in a lot of place names in Israel, and it might equate to our English use, perhaps, of heights following a name, a place name. For the Jews, there was a rich history in this very area of Ramoth, because this was the location 5 miles north of Jerusalem, where Rachel had died in childbirth. Now, the Babylonians were using this as their staging area, and just to remind you, for the captives being assembled, it was going to be a long and painful march. We learn from Ezra 7:9 that the march must have been at least 4 months long, because it took Ezra 4 months to come the other way. So we can see that as they were assembling everybody here that they thought was worth bringing home as booty, everybody knew they were going to be in for a long, hard march. Hence, the words of Jeremiah were of immediate import to the people. Jeremiah himself was held at Ramoth. But the Babylonians, you know, through their spies that were in Jerusalem, no doubt, knew that Jeremiah had been counseling against the policy of not acceding to Babylon. And so they showed him deference. They gave Jeremiah a special pardon and protection in the former territory of Judah. Because remember, at this point, the decision still hadn't occurred that everybody was going to be removed from the land except the very poorest of the poor. We read about this in Jeremiah 40, verses 1 to 3. It says there, the word came to Jeremiah from the Lord after that, and here's the captain of the guard, he's Babylonian, you know, they say you should practice in advance, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard had let him go from Ramah. When he was being taken, bound in chains amongst all that were carried away captive of Jerusalem and Judah to go to Babylon. And the captain of the guard took Jeremiah and said to him, "The Lord thy God hath pronounced evil upon this place." Well, there you have it. You know, the Lord comes in on the side. The Babylonians are more than happy to quote from the Lord when it serves their purposes. "And the Lord hath brought it and done according as he has said, because ye have sinned against the Lord." This isn't coming from Jeremiah or one of the people of Israel. This is coming from a Babylonian head of the guard. "And have not obeyed his voice. Therefore this thing has come unto you. And now, behold, I loose thee this day from the chains that were upon thy hand. If it seem good unto thee, come with me into Babylon. Come, and I'll look well unto thee. If it seem ill unto thee to come with me to Babylon, forbear. Behold, the whole land is before thee. Whether it seemeth good and convenient for thee to go, go thither." So Jeremiah was given a special dispensation from the Babylonians, who recognized that he had certainly not contributed to assisting the defenders of the walls of Jerusalem. But I'm just trying to point out how important Ramoth was. Okay, this is the Babylonian headquarters. This is where our text is focused. And as we know, while Rachel died in childbirth, she did bring forth Benjamin. Let's just read a little further in Jeremiah 31. "Thus saith the Lord, refrain thy voice from weeping, and thine eyes from tears, for thy work shall be rewarded, saith the Lord, and they shall come again from the land of the enemy. And there is hope in thine end, saith the Lord, that thy children shall come again to their own border." Well, what do we have here, brethren? This is a clear promise of return. Perhaps not for the captives themselves. It was going to be a long captivity, but for their children after the dreadful desolation. So that's Ramoth. Now let's look at the next element of our verse 15, Rachel. And Rachel weeping. We find Rachel introduced in Genesis 29, verse 17. She was both beautiful and well-favored. And the young Jacob was smitten by this beauty as only a young man can be smitten. Rachel means a ewe of the sheep. Working 7 years and then 14 years as the price for this beauty were no problem for a young man. You know, you're going to live forever when you're that young. Now, Jacob had actually planned something that would have been in accordance with the divine arrangement that you should have one wife. However, divine providence permitted Laban's deception to provide a broader mix in the gene pool, that's all you can conclude, for the 12 sons of Israel. The marriage of Jacob and Rachel and Jacob and Leah does not seem to have gone smoothly. I mean, some of the best dialogue in the Bible spills out of these chapters of Genesis. And, you know, the reason that we know the Bible is the word of the Lord is that it is so true to life. Now, Leah's the less favored sister. She's the older sister. She's not described as being well-favored and beautiful. She has weak eyes, but she was fertile. And the beautiful Rachel could not conceive. Now, the Lord's providence was in this as well. And we need to take a lesson from this to develop faith in the Lord's watch care over all of our circumstances. But let's just keep looking at this account in Genesis 30. What we find is, really not the relaxing evening conversation that a young man dreams of when he comes back to his tent and his beautiful wife after a long day of tending the flock. Rachel says to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." That's Genesis 31. Well, you know, that's a real conversation opener for dinner. And not surprisingly, Jacob replies nearly in kind. It says, Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel. "Am I in God's stead who's withheld from thee the fruit of thy womb?" Genesis 36. Now, as the story continues, we find that this irritated exchange leads to a poor decision. Oh boy, does that happen to us ever? Well, I can assure you it happens to me a lot. And that's part of the reason that we need to learn the lessons from the scriptures so that we can use them and learn from them. And we don't have time in one human life to make all the mistakes that our brethren, that our examples in the Old Testament have made. You know, we just don't have the time. So we should observe and learn from mistakes. And that's what we have to do with the picture here. And what do we find? Soon enough, Bilhah, the maiden serving Rachel, becomes a surrogate mother. And you've got to love her name. You know, this is a really good servant girl name. It means timid. Okay, so timid the servant girl. Now, thanks to modern archaeology that has been able to translate some of the clay tablets from this very area where Laban would have been. In this time period, the archaeological digs at Nuzi, that's, by the way, a little southwest of modern Kirkuk, if you notice that in the paper. These contracts specified that if the wife should prove childless, she must provide her husband with a slave wife. So this was certainly within what was considered good social custom of the time, but not what the Lord wants. Well, you know, that happens, and it happens to our very day. What is the result of this human decision? Through Bilhah, the tribe of Dan comes into existence. sadly, we find that Dan is so ill-favored that his very name is dropped from the 12 tribes listed in Revelation 7, 5 to 8. You read it through, Dan's not there. Dan's a picture of the second death class. Eventually, Rachel does indeed bear a child, Joseph. We read about that in Genesis 30, 25 through 28. Now, this is the most favored of the sons of Jacob. So here we have an interesting lesson that ties in with our theme. You know, what's done when it's driven by human passions is the least favored. What's done waiting upon divine providence is the most favored. We see that 11 of the 12 sons of Jacob were born outside of the land promised to Abraham. Jacob, his wives, and his children, and his flocks flee Laban to go back. 3 days, head start, but you know, flocks, wives, and children don't move as fast as an upset in-law on a father-in-law on a camel, and it was unsuccessful. Laban goes after them, overtakes them, and there's one final meeting between Laban and Jacob, and they part on less than friendly terms, but they do part in peace because the Lord warns Laban. Now we find that Rachel's the key figure who precipitates another crisis, unwisely endangering her own life by stealing cult idols. Why? You know, why? Again, modern archaeology seems to help a little bit here. These cult objects would have given her husband claim to the father's property. We've learned that from the Newsy excavations and translations, and I have references if you'd like. But Rachel proves to be her father's daughter, and, you know, Laban knows how to lie. Rachel knows how to lie. She misguides her father in the search for the idols. The lies come around full circle. Again, is that an example for us? Yes. What not to do? Okay, so, you know, we got to take these lessons, watch it. These are lessons of what not to do, brethren. But we're picking up the account here in Genesis 35, 16 through 20. And they journeyed from Bethel, and there was but a little way come to Ephrath. And Rachel travailed, and she had a hard labor. And it came to pass that when she was in the hard labor, the midwife said unto her, "Fear not, fear not. Thou shalt have this son also." And it came to pass, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Benoni, but his father called him Benjamin. And Rachel died, and she was buried in the way to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar upon her grave, that is the pillar of Rachel's grave, unto this day. Now, let's just keep the geography straight. She died 5 miles north of Jerusalem. That site was known, and particularly because that was within the inheritance of Benjamin, the son, the very son that she had brought forth. But she was transported about 11 miles south, so when you get to Bethlehem, that's 6 miles south of Jerusalem. And this name she gives, Benoni, means son of my sorrow. But Jacob wisely amended the name to Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. And names matter. They're a source of inspiration. Having a child bear a lifetime of the burden of grief is really not something a parent should do. Nevertheless, Benoni is the dying sentiment of Rachel. What was the context of her passing away in childbirth? They were traveling from Bethel, going southward. Jacob had just received the reassurance, the reaffirmation from God that the blessings were coming to him. That must have thrilled his heart. He must have realized, yes, it was the correct thing for me to come back to the land. This promise has been reaffirmed. What's the next thing that happens in the account? It says, as they are traveling from Bethel, his favored wife dies. So we can get some of the sense of what this passage, focusing on Ramoth, must have meant to the experiences of Israel as the children of Israel were departing for Babylon. The children of Benjamin, because the two tribes were Benjamin and Judah. In fact, it might not be clear to some of us, but the city of Jerusalem is shared between the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. The southern part of the city with the citadel of Zion, former Jebusite city, was part of the inheritance of Judah. Most of the city of Jerusalem, including the temple, were in the territory of Benjamin. So we always find these two tribes together. They co-shared the city. Mount Moriah was in Benjamin and the temple. Now, as and we'll leave this to your study, brethren, as the time presses on, but the next chapter in Jeremiah 32 records Jeremiah buying a field from his cousin and burying the sales contract in an earthen vessel so that it might continue many days until the land was restored. Jeremiah knew that the people of Israel needed to understand that this trial from the Lord was going to be overruled and that there was a promise of return and restoration. Pastor Reisel writes in the Overland Monthly that the labor of parents in raising their children will not be lost. And he's writing about that in the sense of what Jacob did in giving Benjamin a name that was a name of promise instead of a name of sorrow. Rachel labored to bring an heir to Jacob. She brought him two heirs. She made some unwise decisions. But waiting upon the Lord, there was a blessing that came upon her seed. And now, as she labored to deliver Benjamin, give her very life for her son, where does the prophet take us next in the narrative? Well, he talks about Ephraim and their restoration. What was the relationship of Ephraim to Rachel? The grandson, through Joseph. The grandson who was to establish the kingdom with the capital at Samaria. A grandson that she never would meet. A grandson whose people had been taken more than a century earlier, and the promise comes that they will be restored to their land. You can read about this in Jeremiah 31, 18, 19, and 20, but we're going to pass over that. But let's pick up in verse 22. How long will thou go about, O thou backsliding daughter? For the Lord hath created a new thing in the earth, and a woman shall compass a man. Rachel labored in the flesh, and yet both she and her flesh were weak. But this very act, the thing that she worked so hard at, the deliverance of a seed of blessing, would be accomplished by the Lord. And that seems to be one of the senses we can take from this word, a woman shall compass a man. There's a very early reprint article, 350, that picks up on this thought. And a great deal more can be said on this subject because it's clearly a very broad area of its own that you could spend a discourse on. Now notice how this prophecy would have impacted and given encouragement in Jeremiah's day to the people heading on this 4 month or more walk to Babylon, knowing that it's unlikely. We know some of them did come back. Some of them were able to see the foundation of the temple laid, but in general, they were not coming back. But there's one additional element that is important to the way this scripture is applied, and that is Rachel's buried in Bethlehem. And that becomes critical when we pick up the account in Matthew 2:16. And we're reading Matthew 2:16 through 18. Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceedingly wroth, sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem, and in all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. And then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, in Ramah there was a voice heard, lamentation, weeping, and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and would not be comforted because they were not. Yes, once again, there's a bitter disaster falling upon the Lord's people. These infant children were horribly murdered. Their blood was spilled in the presence of their grief-stricken mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters. You know, the houses were small, the families lived together. And how thankful we are, brethren, for the promise of a resurrection. They will return from the borders of the enemy. But I wanted to go in a different direction with this. By the Lord's grace, we have been begotten to a spirit nature and we are called new creatures. What about those used by Satan? Thankfully, there's not quite an equivalency. They are not begotten to the nature of Satan, even though many willingly go down the path of amoral and immoral conduct and become sinful and evil. And King Herod was one of these sociopaths. They're the scorn of history, and you can find them littered through the pages of history. Satan stirred him up to perform this act. But do you think Satan was unaware that Joseph, Mary, and the infant Jesus had safely slipped through this net? He knew it. But you can only do so much to motivate a narcissist and sociopath like Herod. He thought his purpose was accomplished. Herod had to deal with the Romans. You know, the Romans looked at the kind of thing Herod did as the reason that the gods had given them the rule of the world. They were here to bring law and order out of this kind of chaos. And the slaughter in Bethlehem had to be hushed up. But Herod was satisfied, and Satan couldn't push him any further to scout further and see whether a couple had slipped away with an infant. And so the question is, brethren, as we're looking at what Matthew's saying, is Matthew also telling us that this is the only fulfillment of the scripture in Jeremiah 31:15? I think not. As we look within the chapter itself, it's clearly talking about the restoration. It speaks about Ephraim being returned from their captivity. And where I want to bring this is the general picture of Rachel weeping for her children. Partly this was engendered by my surprise when I was looking at the disasters around the 9th of Ab. There's several of them. The first disaster, according to tradition, but it seems quite reasonable, is that the 9th of Ab was the day in which the spies gave their evil report, and the Lord pronounced judgment that they would be wandering 40 years in the wilderness till all the men 20 and older died. Another disaster on the 9th of Ab is the very one under our nose here, the destruction of the temple, the first temple. The destruction of the second temple, this marvelous temple that our sociopath Herod put together. The Temple Mount that still stands was the greatest civil engineering project in the Roman world, a place that civil engineers prided themselves on their skills. Building that Temple Mount, redesigning Mount Moriah from what the Lord had to what Herod thought would be a good Temple Mount, was a massive project. That temple was destroyed on the 9th of Ab. The destruction of the city under Bar Kokhba during the Bar Kokhba rebellion, 9th of Ab. There's other disasters that befell the Jewish people on the 9th of Ab. One that has a special interest to North American audiences is that Ferdinand and Isabella, after reconquering Spain, expelled all the Jews on the 9th of Ab. Because that day was so unlucky, Christopher Columbus waited 2 days afterwards to sail, and he had three Jews in his crew that sailed for the exploration of what they thought was going to be China. He was not good at geometry, but that's okay. He probably knew he was going to run into something. There's a good book on that. First World War broke out on the 9th of Ab, and this is what surprised me. The brethren see this as leading to the Balfour Declaration, something quite positive. That's not the way the Jews see it. They don't see the positive that came out of this. You can check that out on the internet sites. So they just add this as one more day of national disasters because they had been reestablishing themselves in the land and managing to stay under the radar screen, and now they were in conflict. And what did the British Empire want to do after taking over from the Ottomans? They knew that they had to placate the majority Muslim population. So the first thing they did was secure the Temple Mount with guards from India, which was at that time a British colony, and what we would today call Pakistan or Pakistani people, were the Muslims in that group were made the guards at the Temple Mount. And there was absolutely nothing but a piece of paper saying that there will be an establishment of a homeland. It's a marvelous legal basis, but it's nothing more. They did not really act on that. So the Jewish community doesn't really see this as positive. Things got worse. The Holocaust. And in the Jewish community, this is truly a test of faith. Some have come to the conclusion that God loves life, but he doesn't listen to individual prayers. Some have turned away from God thinking, if there was a God, he could not have permitted this. And yet, we know that our God counts even the sparrows offered in sacrifice. There was a purpose. Every one of those who died in the Holocaust was fighting in the front lines for the independence of Israel. The horrors of the Holocaust, when they became known, moved even one of the 20th century's great sociopaths to recognize Israel. Do you know which was the first world government de jure to recognize Israel? The United States was de facto. Thank you. That is very good. De jure, the legal basis was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Stalin, 3 days later, provided the formal diplomatic recognition. And then he had the satellite states of the communist world recognize Israel. The United States did not formally recognize Israel until late in 1949 after their first election, but they did recognize them de facto. So you had the two allies, British just pushed it aside, because what would they have done? They would have continued their policy of, yeah, let's just kind of keep things the way they are, no state. I think this is an example of Rachel weeping for her children. Her children that perished, and yet the Lord is working out something bigger in the picture. And we need to recognize that this is a problem in the Jewish community. And we need to comfort, we need to provide the words of comfort and point them towards the blessings that have come out of this horrible sacrifice. And so, brethren, if these things happen to the natural seed of Abraham, what about us? What about our experiences in the future? Brethren, let us make the best use of these opportunities we have for coming together in convention, for sharing fellowship with our saints, with other saints, for building ourselves up that we may be prepared for what the Lord may be bringing, permitting to come in the future. Satan is against the Lord's program. He's against the natural seed. He's against the spiritual seed. And the natural seed cries out, Benoni, the son of my sorrows. Let us have the perspective of the spiritual seed that says, Benjamin, no, this will be the son of my right hand. This will be what accomplishes the Lord's purpose. And may the Lord add his blessing.